session.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. We are here in the matter of Hogan versus the state. This is case number 54011. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Well, Mr. Owens, ready to proceed?
Yes, I'm ready.
Mr. Abington?
Thank you. May it please the court, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Brian Abington, and I'm an attorney for Michael Hogan. We represent Mr. Hogan, and our office started to represent Mr. Hogan in 2008. My understanding is that the principal issue before the court in this appeal is the question of whether or not Mr. Hogan's actual innocence of the death penalty and actual innocence of the offense are sufficient to overcome Nevada's procedural bars. There are two aggravating circumstances which the state has relied upon to justify Mr. Hogan's death sentence. Those are that he has a prior violent felony conviction, which relates to a 1971 conviction for manslaughter out of the state of Iowa, and he has a grave risk aggravator based on the theory that he is, or the court's finding that he caused a great risk of death to more than one person at the time of the offense. I would submit to the court that Mr. Hogan is actually innocent of those offenses, of those felony aggravators, because they cannot be applied to him under this court's prior rulings. In the case of Jimenez v. State, this court found that a aggravator did not apply where the defendant had fatally stabbed one person with one knife and stabbed another person with another knife. And this was in that finding, the court actually came up with an analogy that actually applies to Mr. Hogan's case, which is the idea that if the person had used a rock, for example, and gone from room to room using a rock to cause the death of the individuals, here a mother and the attempted murder of her daughter, that would not constitute a grave risk. And we would submit to you that the grave risk is not applicable here. In this situation, Mr. Hogan shoots according to the evidence that was deduced at trial, Mr. Hogan shoots the mother in the kitchen while the daughter is hiding in the bathroom. And the case law on this is the state of mind of the shooter at the time of the initial shooting, which will require that Mr. Hogan have known or contemplated that he would be placing the daughter, Shelley Brown, in danger at the time he shot the mother, Heidi Hinckley. And that the idea being that when the court reviewed this and the grave risk and the application of the grave risk aggravator in other cases, they've found that the legislative intent was based on someone who's using a weapon that by its very nature could cause this sort of, could put another person at risk. Say, for example, a bomb or a shotgun, in the case of Moran versus State, shooting at a victim where the person was in a room or in a building occupied by other people where the defendant was unaware of that, the court found that was insufficient. In this particular instance, we would argue that the same thing applies, that when Mr. Hogan is allegedly shooting at the mom in the kitchen, the mother actually yells to the daughter, according to the testimony, tells her to hide. She's in the bathroom. Mr. Hogan shoots her in the bathroom and then later on shoots her in the bedroom. And so that the argument was that this is not what was contemplated by the grave risk statute. The court has, in the years since it first upheld Mr. Hogan's conviction, further defined and further analyzed the application of the great risk aggravator and found that it was not, the legislative intent was not to have it in situations like this. I think in Moran versus,
I'm sorry, Mr. Abington, under your analysis, and I may be making a grave oversimplification of your argument, but if I understand it correctly, absent someone being in the same general vicinity as someone who has a gun, or a bomb, we could never reach the grave risk to others?
No, I don't think that's true. I think in Moran versus State, for example, they found the court found that the second shooting by Mr. Moran, where he actually shoots around somebody, that actually does constitute a grave risk. I think in this, the unique situations of this case.
Are you asking us to separate these events into separate little compartments?
I'm saying that it doesn't qualify under the course of action exception that the court found at the initially to uphold this. That in another example, as the court found in another case, that the course of action aggravator or the course of action justification of the grave risk aggravator was inapplicable in a case where defendants were shooting multiple victims in the city of Reno, going from place to place. The whole event took, that was the theory, was that the course of action.
Would you argue that the daughter would have been shot if she wasn't?
I'm sorry?
But for the daughter being there, she wouldn't have been shot or something of that nature?
I think what I'm saying is at the time that the mother was shot, there was no danger to the daughter from shooting the mother. That the daughter was not in the room, she was not in the zone of danger created by the shot. If it had been a shotgun, that would be might be a better different situation.
If the mother got shot, the daughter was there, he was a witness, kind of put her in that zone?
I would say that her mere presence is not sufficient. If you the facts of this particular case, Mr. Hogan has exited the house and has actually encountered the daughter in the hallway after the second shooting and did not shoot her, told her to go hide in the bathroom, and then left the house. She did not leave the house until after she heard the front door shut and the car door shut. And so at the time those shootings are going on, that this is not it's showing an indication that it's an unaltered course of conduct on Mr. Hogan's part. I would also argue that the prior violent felony aggravating circumstances inapplicable, Mr. Hogan, in as much as the state of Iowa has admitted that conviction is constitutionally infirm. It does not define whether or not Mr. Hogan was actually the offense in Iowa actually involved the use or threat of violence against another person. The plea colloquy in Iowa, the admitted evidence at this trial was not sufficient to hold that aggravator. There's no, at the current pleadings that are before the court, since 1971, no one has ever indicated, other than Mr. Hogan's attorney at the time of the plea, that it was any indicia of intent to kill or intent to cause violence by Mr. Hogan in the 1971 conviction. In fact, the state of Iowa has held that conviction infirm and that it fails to comply with both Iowa and federal requirements. Lastly, Your Honor, I'd like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal, is that we would also argue that Mr. Hogan is actually innocent of the offense itself, that he lacked the sufficient intent to commit this offense, and that there is insufficient evidence of deliberation and premeditation. And as a result, the conviction cannot stand on that as well.
Counsel, with respect to that argument, this court hasn't really defined actual innocence. How would you suggest, if we reach that point, we do so?
I would suggest that the court would adopt the Brecht standard in terms of whether or not the instructions compiled with the evidence that was not admitted due to trial counsel's ineffectiveness combined show that there wasn't a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. It cannot be harmless. That I would say that the actual innocence, the federal actual innocence standard would be applicable, that Mr. Hogan would meet that standard as well. And in previous rulings by this court examining a defendant's state of mind, that Mr. Hogan meets those qualifications as well.
Under Sawyer, additional mitigating evidence is not part of the death eligibility determination. But in Nevada, it is.
Well, in this particular instance, the mitigating evidence also would have been admissible during the guilt phase as well. The indicated what we now know. I mean, trial counsel basically did nothing for Mr. Hogan. Their performance in this case, they admit on the record, even before the trial starts, that they're not prepared. They haven't done an investigation of the Iowa convictions. They had a very poor relationship with Mr. Hogan. In fact, trial counsel admitted that he'd only spent about 26 days preparing for this trial, and that the state at that time argued that you don't need more than 26 days. The court said that it would give trial counsel a one-week continuance, but in fact, the court took that continuance back and forced them to, said it would give a continuance, then granted a one-week continuance instead of allowing counsel to do a complete investigation, which was never done.
Counsel, wasn't there conflicting evidence in the record as to his status during this alleged period, whether or not narcotics were actually ingested or not ingested? And there was conflicting testimony in the record?
I believe that the only thing that I would say as far as a conflict is I believe that there was cocaine recovered from the scene, that several witnesses testified, including Shelley Brown, the one of the victims in this case, that Mr. Hogan and her mother had used intoxicants and drugs and cocaine, and that was not unusual. I think the only evidence that
they had used, but on this occasion, was her testimony that she had.
Yes, I believe at the time of his arrest, Mr. Hogan tells the police officers, he says, go inside the bathroom, you find the cocaine there, it'll really mess you up. They go in the bathroom, and there's cocaine there. There's a little silver case with the gold-colored razor blade and a silver tube for snorting cocaine.
But I think the question is whether or not there was any evidence presented that Mr. Hogan, in fact, was under the influence of those drugs.
Several witnesses testified to the fact that these witnesses had been on a weekend-long binge of alcohol and drug addiction and smoking. I believe that Ms. Brown talked about them smoking marijuana on the day in question, and I know that Mr. Hogan himself testified that he had been using cocaine.
You want to comment on latches in this case?
I would say, Your Honor, that my understanding that it would be a miscarriage of justice and a fundamental miscarriage of justice would result if this court was not to resolve these claims. I don't think that latches actually applies in the sense that a lot of the claims that Mr. Hogan first raised in his own pro se petition are the issues that are before the court. His direct appeal was handled by the same public defender's office that said they were going to withdraw from his trial and said that they weren't ready to represent him. They didn't raise any claims regarding their failures in this case. And post-conviction counsel only filed an 8-page supplement to the petition that Mr. Hogan filed for himself. I mean, the representation in this case is quite abysmal. I have about 2.5 minutes left. I could say that would be great.
Thank you. Mr. Owens.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of Nevada.
Mr. Owens, could you comment on the latches situation in this particular case as far as
attorney's position? You're talking about statutory latches in 34.800. That is certainly one of three procedural bars that should apply. Actual innocence is a claim that can overcome them, is what this court's jurisprudence has been. Insofar as they're alleging actual innocence of the death penalty, that claim has been made numerous times. In fact, when we were last before this court, there was an order of affirmance just in 2007, or 2006, I believe, where this court said it had twice before ruled on the applicability of these two aggravating circumstances to the defendant's case and upheld them. So in 2006 was the third time, and now here is the fourth time. Aggravating circumstances are going to be looked at in terms of narrowing them or looked at in terms of whether they actually apply to the factual scenario of a case. I think that really needs to be done on direct appeal. I think it sets bad precedent to do it on appeal from the denial of a fourth state habeas petition where we've got all this law of the case that says repeatedly it does apply, know all these documents they've uncovered about the Iowa conviction, don't change the pre-existing ruling in this case that this was a prior crime of violence. To upset all of that precedent in the case now, I think would be inappropriate. And so the argument for narrowing and for applicability of particular aggravators is a direct appeal claim. So I don't see how that constitutes actual innocence of the death penalty. It's largely controlled by law of the case at this point. Actual innocence of the murder. What they've got now, at trial they had Dr. O'Gorman. That was in 1985. The murders were in 1984. It's been 24, 25 years, and they go get another neuropsychologist. This is Dr. Mack, Jonathan Mack, who has yet another take, another explanation of the report of what was going on in the defendant's mind, and it's largely that report and a pharmacological report by Dr. Lipman, who never even saw, never interviewed the defendant. That's the basis for the actual innocence of the crime of murder. It's basically saying that the defendant was incapable. 25 years after the fact, they're going to make an opinion that he was incapable of forming the intent to deliberate. That's how I understand their actual innocence claim. Fortunately, the mens rea element is still something that is determined by juries and is a question of fact. It's not something that is determined by experts. While they can render some helpful information that may be relevant to whether or not someone has in fact formed an intent to premeditate and deliberate, it is not dispositive. And for that reason, I don't think should be considered evidence of actual innocence. Their expert in this case, actually his findings were that Mr. Hogan was not insane at the time of the crime. I think it takes something along the lines of insanity to even have a discussion about actual innocence of murder, insofar as he was capable or not capable of forming that intent. They make a finding he was not insane. He knew what he was doing was wrong and knew the nature, purpose, and quality of his actions. It is, however, the examiner's opinion that Mr. Hogan was nonetheless less responsible for his actions due to the drug intoxication, alcohol. Less responsible. He's talking about mitigation.
It would only be second-degree murder under the Fox case. That's the best he could come up with, the second-degree murder with that.
And that's what was argued at trial. And they brought out the impulsivity through Dr. O'Gorman, the impulsivity of Michael Hogan, the fact that he was probably doped up on drugs and alcohol and lack of sleep, and that his thinking was disorganized and he didn't know what he was doing and didn't deliberate and premeditate. That was the defense at trial. There's nothing new here in terms of new evidence for a constitutional error. Those are prerequisites, to my understanding, to actual innocence. Some change in the facts. All we've got is a new opinion that goes a little bit further, a little bit beyond what Dr. O'Gorman found, and it's based on 25 years of time. I don't think that's the sort of thing that constitutes actual innocence of guilt. Otherwise, every time they come back on a successive petition, all they'll need is another expert's opinion. We had O'Gorman in 2000 or 1985 at trial. On post-conviction, they had Schmidt in 1998. In 2001, they had Rosenthal, and now 2008, they've got Mack. That's what they do. They get a new expert, they get a new opinion, and they come back and allege actual innocence. And if that's going to be enough, then none of these cases are ever going to be final, and we'll always be reassessing and evaluating whether somebody's actually innocent.
Well, that's the reason I brought up the laches issue, because until recently, with all the DNA stuff, that's what's getting people to have their convictions reversed after a substantial amount of time. And I think that the laches argument you've got to look at, because even in fact, if you had to try this case again, could the DA come up with witnesses after 25 years? I mean, that's a burden on the state.
That's
when they've
problem.
Had the opportunity, and believe me, I had O'Gorman on the stand numerous times. That's dirty. He was a very good psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Mr. Owens, could you comment on counsel's argument about invalid aggravators?
Well, great risk of death. This was based on the language about there being a course of action. I'm hesitant to get back into the merits of the applicability of that, where it's been ruled on so many times, but factually we have the defendant shooting the mother and then immediately going over and shooting the young daughter, and then as she gets away and goes into a bedroom, coming back in and shooting her again and telling her, ripping the phone out of the wall, and then telling her to go into the bathroom and not come out. as a course of action with a gun in this case, not a knife, as was used in Jimenez. It's a weapon capable of causing damage to more than one person, as opposed to a knife directed at one person, generally is not putting others at risk. And that's been a big basis of this court's jurisprudence for defining the crime of great risk of death going forward ever since 1987, the decision on direct appeal. We've all cited back to this course of action language. If there needs to be some narrowing of it, that can happen in cases on direct appeal. I don't think there needs to. I think it was appropriately applied repeatedly throughout this case based on that course of conduct language. I'm thinking of cases such as Zane Floyd. I know the prototypical case of great risk of death might be a bomb going off where there's a crowded room. But we have cases like Zane Floyd, and I don't remember whether this was an aggravator in that case or not, but I think it would certainly apply, where he systematically goes around and shoots one person, goes to the next aisle and in the grocery store and shoots someone else, goes in the back room, shoots someone else. Great risk of death to more than one person by means of a weapon. I think that's the theory under which that aggravator has applicability. Prior crime of violence, they have sought to undermine that by going back to Iowa and attacking that one and getting affidavits from the prosecutor. They have bent over backwards to try to undermine the applicability of this. I brought up this Hogan case when this court was narrowing the aggravator in the Redeker case. I said, hey, keep in mind, you got Hogan out here that's been law of the case, and this has been precedent going forward. Please take that into account, and I think this court did. And in the last appeal in 2000... six, you looked at Redeker and said it did not apply retroactively to Hogan's crime here. And so I think under the law in existence at the time, and perhaps even today, I don't think we need to go there, though, because it is controlled by law of the case, and Redeker does not apply. At the time, it was certainly considered a crime of violence. And, so I don't see that. That's just a repeat of what's previously gone in this case. I think the more interesting issue is actual innocence of the guilt, and going back after 25 years, I just think this is not the appropriate means to establish actual innocence, or we're going to have it in every case. I think the Pellegrini case in 2001, this court's Pellegrini case is instructive. Something similar happened where they had an expert at trial who, like Dr. O'Gorman, gave some minimal testimony about state of mind and what was going on and that he couldn't premeditate and deliberate. And then they came back on post-conviction with another doctor. And this court gave some interesting language analyzing what was then a new diagnosis of multiple personality disorder. This court discussed in the insanity argument that I made earlier. They said, we note that reasonable jurists have disagreed on whether proof of legal insanity satisfies the actual innocence benchmark of the fundamental miscarriage of justice exception. So that's where I get that that notion that if you're going to attack state of mind as an actual innocence and say that he's not guilty of premeditated murder, you've got to come up with something like insanity, and then we can discuss it. And even that, there's controversy about whether even that is going to apply. Actual innocence is supposed to be extraordinarily rare, and yet every one of these capital defendants is raising it, and they're raising it repeatedly, and delaying the normal process through the court system. The fact that we're here on a fourth state habeas petition that was not intended to be so. The legislature did not intend that 25 years later we'd still be arguing state law issues that should have been moved forward to federal already. So I don't think they've shown actual innocence. I don't think any evidentiary hearing was necessary to dispose of this claim. It probably should have been summarily dismissed. The legislature provided for summary disposition of some of these petitions without even requiring a response from the state. I think the courts below need to start utilizing that. The Pellegrini case did not use, there was no evidentiary hearing necessary to make out or decide that that was not a claim of actual innocence that would result in any relief. I believe that's all I have, unless there's any further questions.
Questions, colleagues?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Mr. Addington.
Thank you. What about Mr. Owens' argument that you can always go get another expert and time again overcome that if you can?
I understand that, and it was actually a really good point, and you made a good point, which is that Dr. O'Gorman was a good psychiatrist, and if we were doing the standard thing that what Mr. Owens is saying of just, we don't like what this guy says, we'll find another one, we'll find another one. But the problem here is, back in 1984, in 1985, when they tried this case, the counsel had never met with Dr. O'Gorman before they put him on the stand. Nobody would do that. Just say that out loud. In a capital case, the lawyer put the most important witness to explain the guy's state of mind. He never met him. He never read his report. He never talked to him. He had no idea what he was going to say. How could he pick a jury without knowing what the state of mind was going to be? He didn't know what the doctor's report was going to say. How could he make a decision about whether or not to put the defendant on the stand where you don't know what the guy's supposed to say? In 1985, May 7, 1985, trial counsel from the public defender's office, Marcus Cooper, filed an affidavit with the court saying the investigation needed in order to render adequate and effective assistance of counsel has not been completed. Affiant is informed that there exists evidence which tend to exculpate defendant's involvement in the Iowa manslaughter case, but additional time is needed to finalize. Due to the restraints placed on Affiant's investigators outlined in his earlier affidavit, this was their third motion for continuance. They are having a doctor testify that they've never met. I mean, the level of incompetence that was allowed to stand in 1985 is just outrageous.
Counsel, you are criticizing the expert, but...
I'm not criticizing the expert, Your Honor. I'm criticizing counsel's use of the expert.
What was brought out at the time of trial, though, very similar to the new information that's been put before subsequent courts.
But with the when what's
in
happened
in terms of
is,
the finding of that expert,
with the improper instructions that were given at his trial, and the lack of almost complete lack of representation at the direct appeal stage, because of the fact that the same PD's office is representing this guy on direct appeal, then we get to the state post conviction where he only files an 8-page supplement to the defendant's own petition, and then we apply law to case, law to case, law to case, law to case, and now we're done. And that's no analysis has ever taken place deeper than that.
Other questions, colleagues?
Counsel, fundamentally, since you're talking about a fundamental miscarriage of justice, equate that with the proposition that you are entitled not to a perfect trial, but to a fair trial. How do those two equate to each other?
I think Mr. Hogan was completely deprived of a fair trial. His lawyers didn't know. When they play the 911 tape at his trial, the lawyer says, I'd like to see that. I haven't listened to the tape yet. The most important, most damaging evidence that comes in this case is the screaming little 16-year-old, and his lawyer hasn't listened to the tape? That's not what it means to be a lawyer in the state of Nevada. That's what you get to say, is that you can't do that. And Judge Mendoza should not have forced this man to trial. They weren't ready. They didn't know what they were doing. They were in over their heads. And it's been that way for 27 years.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the next call of the court.